Welcome to Doc Talks Fishing, where science and fishing make a big splash. Join Gord and Liam with this week's guest.
Hey folks, Gord here, and Liam's with me. And I know we say this probably every show, every episode, but trust me, this one is special. When you have the best in the world, and we're talking one of the finest fisheries science laboratories on Earth is at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and it's the Tufts Research Lab. And we have Dr. Bruce Tufts as our guest today.
Yeah, well, so what we're going to be talking about is a subject that's applicable to all fish, saltwater, freshwater, and it's not species specific either. What we're talking about today is why big fish matter. Bruce Tufts popularized this saying, big fish matter, and it's so true. I mean, we'll talk about this in the episode, but each lake is maybe slightly different, but it functions as an ecosystem. It is an ecosystem. It's very, very complex, the food webs, and each species plays a very important role in all of that. And the big fish of each species play a huge role in the species. If you get what I'm saying here, big fish are important to the species, and the species are important to the overall ecosystem of a lake. So that just amplifies the importance of big fish, and that's what we're going to dive into today.
And you know, the other thing that's really important, I get so many emails, letters to the magazines, and we all make the mistake, and Liam and I include ourselves in this. We think of fish in human terms, and it is the worst possible thing we can do. We're going to learn today some things that will absolutely blow your mind about why big fish, when they're 10, 15, 20 years old, why their eggs are so important, why they're so much more viable, why they're so much bigger, why everything about them is so much better than small fish. And we always make the mistake, we talk to folks and we say, you know, let the small ones go. And I always say to folks, let the small ones go. Why? And they say, so they can become big. And well, if you've got a big fish in your hand, let it go. And you're going to find today, whether we're talking about muskies, walleyes, northern pike, lake trout, smallmouth, largemouth bass, why those fish are so absolutely incredible to the population. And I'm actually wearing a shirt right now, and it was one Bruce sent to me, and emblazoned on it is the slogan, big fish matter, and that's what we're going to talk about today with Bruce.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. Well, and I mean, big fish, they matter a ton in a population, and there's just so many reasons. And the cool thing too is that as science evolves, as these specialists learn a little bit more, it's going in the trend to just prove that big fish matter more and more and more and more. The science is just proving the more data that these guys collect, the more it shows that big fish matter. So before we have Bruce on, I would like to thank Rapala. Rapala, so they just launched a new lure line, a new soft plastic bait brand called Crush City. These lures, so they feature a smart injection technology, and basically what that is a very advanced technique of creating these lures. They're very, very detailed. If you look at them, they're extremely detailed. They're salt and scent infused, so the salt and scent is directly in the bait. The other thing is there's a ton of benefits. The PVC bait's actually phthalate free, which is the phthalate is a harmful chemical, and they don't have that in these plastisol baits. And then the super TPE is the stuff that's extremely, extremely stretchy. It's really, really hard to break. You can catch tons and tons of fish on it. The other cool thing is it doesn't freeze, So for you ice anglers out there, you're going hole to hole, your bait's not freezing in between spots. And it also doesn't have any memory. So if you put these in a bag or in a pack of baits, your TPE baits aren't going to come out all twisted and bent. I don't try it out. I've done a ton of testing with these baits. I've spent the last year. I actually caught a 30-pound lake trout. It was crazy. It was 36 by 25 and a half. So it was built like the shape of a bathtub. And I caught that fish on a freeloader. So try it out. I've put it through a ton of testing, and like we say, try these baits and take a trip to Crush City.
I'm going to thank the good folks at Williams Lures in Sherbrooke, Quebec. And if you've followed me over the years, you know whether I've gone for northern pike, muskies, walleyes, bass, brook trout, lake trout. Williams Lures, my Williams spoon box, never leaves the boat. It is always with me. And Liam was talking about a giant lake trout that he talked. We were up on Lake Athabasca a few years back, and our go-to trolling bait to find those big schools of fish were Williams spoons. They happened to be Williams whitefish. But another time, I was up in Reindeer Lake on the Saskatchewan-Manitoba border, and we were there in late summer, probably the worst time to go for giant northern pike. And I always remember we went to a little bay, and it had cabbage weeds growing in the shallow bay, but it was right adjacent to the deepest water in the lake. And I had on a Williams spoon, and I always take the treble hook off, and I thread on a 5 or 6 inch silver or white grub so that it looks like a fishtail coming behind. And I'll never forget, the guide said, "I know there's cabbage weeds in here, not very many. There's only 25 or 30 cabbage strands scattered somewhere in the bay here." Anyway, my partner and I, we started casting, and we were intentionally casting the lures, the white fish with the white twister tail on the back. We were casting them intentionally to try and snag a weed stalk. And I'll never forget Mark. He got stuck on a weed and he goes, "Oh, there's a weed." And he popped it loose. It was the biggest northern pike weighed in at the lodge that year. In the next half hour, casting Williams spoons with white 5-inch curly tail grubs attached to the treble hook at the back, we weighed in 4 of the biggest top 10 northern pike caught at the lodge that year. And it's all about the fact that the folks at Williams adorn their spoons with jewelry grade silver, and believe it or not, 24 karat gold. We were casting out in that clear water, and we could see the baits just wobbling coming through, and we were watching huge northern pike coming up and crushing them, thinking that they were big silver. So I never go fishing without my Williams spoon in the tackle box.
Bruce, welcome to today's show.
How are you doing?
I'm good, Gord. It's good to talk to you again. Liam, it's great to meet you, at least virtually.
Yeah. You mean real life soon?
It's how we meet a lot of people these days. Yeah,
it's fun. Yeah, it really. And Bruce, I'm wearing the Queen's University shirt, and this is probably a good way to start the podcast, but a few years back, you sent me this shirt that I'm wearing, and you had emblazoned on the sleeve the slogan, "Big Fish Matter." Why do big fish matter?
Yes, that's I remember sending you the shirt, Gord, and that's a great story, actually, in itself, sending you that shirt, because as I told you earlier, that when I first did that, I wasn't sure how people would think about that and whether it was a good idea or not. And it's caught on, and people, first of all, really like the shirts. And the second part is just because these days, it's incredible how much science is coming out and still coming out about the value of big fish in fish populations. And in many different ways, they're incredibly important. And I think there's a huge misconception about that, which I think is, you know, something we need to talk about today.
Yeah. Bruce, another term, big fish matter, but another term that came out probably, I don't know, 5 to 10 years ago, it's BOFF, B-O-F-F-F-F. And what it stands for is big, old, fat, fertile female fish. And they're just so incredible to the population. And I believe it was some folks from the University of Hawaii, and I know they were studying it on saltwater species, but what they said was, and I'm going to read this, but they said the loss of big fish decreases the productivity and stability of fishery stocks. And they said this loss is known as size and age truncation. I don't have a clue what that means, so tell me.
Sure, absolutely. So what's interesting is that all different species have different life history strategies, and they tweak different parts of those life history strategies to try to maximize their fitness or leave more offspring. And with regard to BOFFs, it's a life history part of the life history strategy in many species. And what it is to begin with, is that a 12-pound female, a big old female in a given species, is not the same as having 3-4-pound females when it comes to reproduction. So they, you know, you do the math, they both equal 12 pounds. And for a long time, fisheries managers would say, okay, well, what's the biomass of the spawning stock? Oh, yeah. And it would just be a number. And what the BOFF's hypothesis was talking about when that came out was that, in fact, as fish age, they're putting less energy into growth and more energy into reproduction and the quality of those reproductive events. So in the example I just gave you, a 12-pound female is producing far more eggs than those 3-4-pound females if you equal it all out to weight. So there's more of an investment. And what it means is basically that as big females get older, their contribution of quality eggs is exponential in the population. And so those are really important fish. And the paradox with that is that those tend to be the fish that traditionally we've removed from fish populations, either through commercial fishing, which is where that example came from, which was a fellow named Mark Hickson, who's a scientist at University of Hawaii now. And another real famous scientist in this area is a guy named Jeff Hutchings. He unfortunately passed away a few years ago. He was a good friend of mine, about the same age, and he worked on cod for much of his career. And cod is another species where the BOFF's hypothesis holds, and big old fertile females are really, really important. Mm-hmm. And this is thought to be why cod populations in Atlantic North America have not recovered from the collapse after commercial fishing.
Wow.
That the age structure of the population is now without all those large BOFFs, and that's thought to be something that's very hard, and this is important, very hard to recover once we lose that in a population.
You know, something I've always said, Bruce, and you know, I worked here with M&R for actually 31 years on Lake of the Woods, and you know, we've had some issues. What we experienced, whether it was with walleyes or muskies, whatever, however long it takes you to create the problem, it takes two or three times that to recover from it, if you're lucky. Even that's not equal. If you drive the stocks down, and you might do that over 20, 30 years, it's like it takes 40, 50, 60 to come back.
Hmm. Absolutely. No, that's a really good way of thinking about it. And, you know, as you know, I teach fisheries biology at Queen's. And it's so interesting when you start looking at these different life history strategies and how different species combine them. And what can happen in some of these environments is that it's almost like the table gets flipped. Once the table gets flipped and those big old fish are removed, then even the forage that they used to forage on can take over. And it's very hard for the original species to get through that bottleneck. It's like sometimes the predators can become prey as younger fish, and then what used to be the prey can actually keep them down. And so you have a whole combination of these things happening if you let things get out of hand. And that's why, you know, when I teach, it's such an important message that over the millions of years that Mother Nature has led to what we have, it's right. You know, it works right, and it works the best way. We've got so many examples of where we've tried to intervene, and I don't want to get off the topic here, but for example, I was just teaching the other day about our original view of hatcheries was that hatcheries were probably a good mitigation strategy for building power dams on salmon rivers.
100%.
And if you drive to the east coast of Canada, you can see there's a hatchery at MacDaquac, which is where there's a large power dam on the St. John River.
Wow.
And it was put there as a mitigation for that power dam. And the St. John River salmon stock has never been the same since.
Yeah. In fact, Bruce, this is so interesting. I was reading something very similar recent to the Columbia River and the Snake River out west. And I believe historically, like the Grand Banks and Cod, but I believe the Columbia River had the largest runs of Chinook and Coho salmon in the world. And on almost every one of those major spawning rapids, they constructed a dam. And I know I'm using the wrong term here. They bought off the anglers, if you will, by saying, well, we'll compensate. We'll build you a hatchery. And those salmon today are on the endangered species list or heading towards it. And the other thing, you know, we always used to say is, well, if it was meant to be there, it would be there in terms of those other species. And you know, it just keeps coming back to what we're talking about. Big old fish matter. And Liam, you know, tell Bruce about the musky, big musky jaw you found.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'll tell you about that. Just to backtrack slightly, I thought it was, I chuckled there when you brought up the hydro dams and these fish, because pure coincidence, that was actually a huge portion of the last podcast we just had. So it was kind of funny that you brought it up, but, So the big musky jaw, actually, when I was swimming, I was younger, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, 6 years, 7 years ago, I was swimming in Lake of the Woods, and we found this, like, humongous musky jaw. It was unbelievably big, and it had been baked in the sun, and the birds picked off all the flesh, but it was the jaw was broken kind of at the back, but it was at the widest portion, like easily 9 inches wide and long, to, like, just the biggest jaw I've had. Like, I've caught many muskies over 50 inches, and they're like, it's just not even close to the same size. So I can't even fathom how big this fish must have been. Yep. But like Gord always says, everybody goes, oh, it's such a shame that fish died. But likely it's a sign of a good fishery that fish made it to that size. And I would presume died of old age.
Absolutely. Probably natural mortality.
Right. And that's a good thing, right?
Which is a good thing. And that's a natural occurrence, and it happens in all fisheries. And A lot of the challenging part of managing fisheries, as you probably know, Gord, is figuring out what portion of the population is going to die from natural mortality and what portion of the population is going to die from fishing mortality. And so I think probably what we're really talking about here today is what we should be thinking when we're contributing to that fishing mortality. Because what we decide to take as selective harvest from a lot of these populations these days, it's in the hands of a lot of individual anglers. I mean, sometimes if we've got a lot of forward-thinking managers, then we've got slot limits that are trying to protect the most valuable part of the population. But I think even in those cases, we've probably got a lot of fine-tuning to do with slot limits.
Right.
Based on the discussion we're having today, I know that a lot of original slot limits would allow people to take big fish at the far size spectrum where we're talking today, really, really big fish, and they would call it a social part of the slot. So it isn't even a biologically determined thing. It's just that, you know, we've only got a few of these big fish. It's probably the way we used to think was it's probably okay if we let fish reproduce when they're smaller for a few years, and then as they get bigger, and probably some of the thinking like we've talked about today from a human perspective, thinking, well, maybe as they get bigger and older, they're not contributing offspring that are as valuable to the population or as many. And in fact, what we're learning now is that just the opposite is true.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot of fisheries, and I've got one in my backyard here at the Bay of Quinte where we've still got limits that allow people to take those giant trophy fish. And it's largely for social reasons.
Yeah.
And unfortunately the science hasn't gotten in there to protect those fish, and it ends up being in the hands of anglers. So that's why what you guys are doing with this kind of thing is really important, because I think those messages need to get out to the people.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I cringe sometimes looking at some of the fish that get killed out of the Bay of Quinte. It's unfortunate, but you said, I just wanted to ask you about something you said earlier, just to clarify something. So 3-4 pound fish, which are equal to 12 pounds, produce in total less egg yield than 1 12-pound fish.
Yes, and that's the classic example that I think that helps people understand this.
Yeah, okay.
And it's because if you know what an exponential curve looks like, as big females grow in size, the number of eggs that they produce, and that we're just talking numbers right now, but actually the quality as well, is exponentially better than those younger females.
In fact, Bruce, we have a good friend, and he was on actually our first podcast, Jeff Madity. And Jeff's a biologist. He works at the very large, I think it's a central hatchery in Saskatchewan, so the big Saskatchewan fish hatchery. And Jeff told us his heart skips a beat when they're doing egg collection for walleye. If they can catch a walleye over 10 pounds, and he said it mirrored exactly what you said. It's not only the fact that there are many more eggs. Jeff said they're virtually 100% viable, and they're twice the size of those smaller 3-4 pound walleye and their eggs. And Jeff said they just bloom. They hatch. And he said his heart skips a beat when they can catch those double-digit fish for the hatchery.
That's not surprising to me, but I bet it's surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah. Right.
And the reason for that, and there are multiple reasons, but the eggs in those big, big females are bigger eggs, and they also, in a number of species, has been shown that they have more fat content, more oil. They're more nutritious for the larvae that will be growing out of them. And it's been shown that it in, and in a number of species that the larvae that come out of those eggs have a much better chance of survival. Yeah. And even in the wild, after, you know, after they've been exposed to different environmental conditions, which is where the toughest part of the life history is for wild fish, is that first year when they've got to get through their first winter in Canada, for example. That stage is what really matters. It's called recruitment. And those big eggs have been shown to produce larvae that have a much better time getting recruited to the population.
So not only is there more eggs in these larger fish, the eggs are healthier, but when the larvae hatch, they're actually more likely to survive than a smaller fish's larvae.
Exactly.
That's nuts.
Yeah, and the pieces are, in some of these cases, I have to say, and it's good for the audience to hear, that some of the science comes from different species, but what's interesting as a scientist is it's kind of like you look back 25 years ago and you see kind of a blurry picture of how things are working. And then people do a bunch of research on different species, and it's like the picture starts to come into better focus.
Right.
And we've known for a long time that recruitment is incredibly important, but it's been much more recently that people have been focusing on what they call these maternal effects. So this is where we're talking about BOFs. So what the importance of the female quality and age and size is to recruitment. And we've known for a long time that recruitment is incredibly important, but what's coming to the forefront now is the maternal effects in that recruitment.
Huh. Wow.
And to give a shout out to the males, and Bruce, you're kind of an expert on bass, the work you've done on Lake Ontario and working with MNR and Dr. Mark Ridgway and the folks down there. Male bass, they're one of the very few species, but smallmouth, where the male actually protects the nest. And we're going to have actually Barry Corbett on the show, on the podcast. And Barry was actually my biologist here on Lake of the Woods and did one of the longest continuous tracking. It was 3 to 5 years we tracked smallmouth on a daily basis. And they were big males, Bruce, that had been protecting the nest. And what Barry discovered, and Mark as well, is the biggest smallmouth were the first to spawn. So they came in earlier, far earlier actually than the smaller males. In fact, the smaller males were the very, very last. And folks may not think 3 weeks is a long time in the spring, but when those big males were in and then 3 weeks later the smaller, the fish, the young of the year, the recruitment, was actually attributable to the biggest males because of everything that you just said.
Yes, and that's a good point. So it's not just, we're not just talking about females here, but you know, I think this, if we went into lots of different areas, and we will go into some, males, big males are also incredibly valuable to the population.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's probably good for some people to hear. In bass, we've been doing a lot of aging in recent years. So we often, when we do get fish that have died, we go back to the lab and age those fish using the ear bones or otoliths, which provides a really accurate number in big old fish. And we've now seen smallmouth, I think our oldest one's 21 years old. We had a tournament mortality that was 21 years old. And so, you know, it takes a long time. Those fish have been around. You think, what was going on 20 years ago? Those fish have been around for a long time. It takes a long time to get those fish back, but they're also incredibly important.
Yeah. You know, the oldest one I remember that we aged on Lake of the Woods was 23 years old. And I never thought of it in the way you just said it, but yeah, imagine thinking back what you were doing 23 years ago, and that fish hatched that year.
Exactly. And a few years later, it was probably spawning on the same site that it spawned on for the next 15 years.
Yes. I wasn't doing anything 23 years ago.
I always have to be careful what examples I use in class these days. I have the same problem.
That's funny.
Bruce, what we're really saying too, I think, and you can talk about we anglers, and I'll include myself in this, the mistake I think we make, we think in human terms. So, you know, a 50, 70, 80-year-old human is frail and obviously not reproducing, not having babies. But fish aren't humans. And we tend to equate fish and wildlife in human terms. And I think it's actually one of the biggest mistakes we can make.
Absolutely. I spend so much time when I'm teaching trying to dispel myths that we have from that traditional perspective. We call it anthropomorphism, looking at things through our human lens. And there are so many animal examples where that's the wrong way to look at things. As a teacher, that's a big part of my job, teaching biology, is to teach people that, that's the wrong perspective in many cases.
Right. So I just have a quick question. Obviously, this is kind of anthropomorphic, but we were talking to Nick Bacante recently. He headed up the walleye research in Northern Ontario, and he mentioned that the walleyes actually. And I'm just going to use these terms, and this is what I'm referring to.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Like educate or teach, that, for lack of a better term, they show the younger fish what to do. And so Lake of the Woods is such a dynamic lake. It's actually technically a flowage. It's every year it changes a little bit. The current bends around this island. There's 14,522 islands. So there's a lot that can happen. The water level can rise. The current can flow this way. The water level can drop. This bay might be windblown for the majority of this year, and it causes certain things to change in these spawning areas. So the older fish actually gain this, again, in quotations, this form of knowledge of the area, and that's literally irreplaceable. You can't give this knowledge to a younger fish. These older fish just have this understanding of the area, and then when there's actually younger fish that come in, the younger year classes, as soon as they reach the age of maturity, they would look to these older fish for a sense of guidance in the area. They'll show them, they'll lead them to the proper spawning grounds, and then post spawn they'll lead them to the nutritious food sources that are out pelagic. It just blew my mind hearing this, because you, like, thinking back as an angler, there's two things really that stick out in my mind for the importance of big fish. One, that's like good eggs, good egg genetics, let's say, and then egg yield. But now there's this form of knowledge that comes into the mix. Is there anything else I'm missing? Because this seems to get more and more interesting the more I dive into it.
Yeah, no. My wife says I don't have a real job, because I just get fascinated by these things and have been my whole career. And every time I dive into the literature, I teach classes and have to go into the literature and the scientific publications that are out in a given field. And there's so many new interesting findings every year that I update my lectures pretty much right to the last minute in my classes. And just what you're talking about is something that's come out in the scientific literature on fish in the last, it's been around for a while, but people speculate typically in the literature. And then after a few years, people start to dive in and actually try to do research that proves or disproves something.
Right.
And there's been a number of different areas now that have shown that fish can learn from each other, social learning. And here I'm going to diverge for a second, because this is something that I think explains something really fascinating that anglers, especially I hang around with a lot of tournament anglers, have kind of believed as a cult thing. But if you start catching fish out of a school and you keep releasing fish back into that school, the school can shut down. And you won't be catching fish after a few minutes continuously from that school. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is explained by social learning. And mm-hmm. and the more people have done experiments on fish and realized that fish can learn from each other, whether it's where to go to eat, what to eat, and what to avoid in terms of predators, but also this part of what we're talking about here, following older fish to important areas for feeding or on migration routes, is something that's coming out more and more in the scientific literature on fish, is that it is probably the case that in many populations, the younger fish are learning their routes for these things from older fish. And a fascinating example of some of the proof that's come together on that is that when we've really damaged some commercial fish stocks, when they collapse, the migration areas change. So as fish that are younger fish with, imagine, you know, basically growing up on your own without any adult guidance, you might go astray, is they find that some of these populations don't have the same spawning areas anymore that they did when older fish were plentiful.
Right. So you're basically removing that knowledge.
Exactly.
And so they have to teach themselves new. Do you think the knowledge of the older fish is better, or it's like, do you think that newer fish kind of figured out a new modern way of doing it?
Well, and if you teach about natural selection, you know, over time, Mother Nature tends to cull out the ones that are doing it the wrong way. And we have that in humans too, and we don't want to get on. We don't want to get onto that tangent. But I think that I think there was a great publication that used to come out. I don't know if it still does, but I think it was something about the Darwin Awards. I think it was called, and it would show examples of humans that just did dumb things and didn't survive.
Yeah.
But
Bruce, I think this relates to the very same thing, and it's back to the folks at the University of Hawaii, and they said that the research has pointed out, and it's something I think we often fail to remember, and what they said was, and I'm going to quote here, they said, old fish can outlive periods that are unfavorable for reproduction, and it provides what they call a storage effect where boffs are ready to spawn successfully when the time is right. And that's almost unfathomable.
Yeah, but that's a great statement. I mean, in terms of their ability to survive challenging environmental conditions, old fish have more energy reserves, and you know, we've just talked about the fact that they may have more knowledge of where to go for wintering areas and things like that. And so that statement is totally consistent with everything that I think we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And that another reason why they're so valuable is that they are there and ready and have survived some of these challenging conditions through a combination of the things that we're talking about, and then can produce an incredible number of high quality eggs when the time is right.
So Bruce, how did you get, because obviously big fish matter, I mean, like, how did you get on to this? Because like, that's kind of your tagline in a sense, you've popularized that saying, but big fish matter. But how did you get on to that, like, specifically?
That's a good question. And it's kind of been in stages. But when I decided to produce those T-shirts, my lab crew was going out to a lot of competitive fishing events, a lot of bass tournaments. And I think what a lot of tournament anglers needed to learn, and we've worked away at it, and the T-shirts were one part of that, was the value of the fish they're bringing into weigh-ins for the fish population is incredible for all the reasons we've talked about. And so something else that I think my lab has become well known for, I've actually spent a lot of time as a physiologist earlier in my career, and trying to teach anglers how to look after those big fish in their live wells so that they can be released alive at the end of these live release bass fishing tournaments, which is what the goal is, but not always the case when bad things happen. And so I was popularizing that really at the same time that we were showing tournament anglers what the ages of the fish are that they're weighing in, and trying to educate them on the value of those fish to the fish population, and trying to get them to just be extra vigilant on the fish in their live well, learn how to look after them properly. They're not just a commodity in a bass tournament. They're actually a, you know, we're lucky to use them, and we need to look after them.
Yeah.
Folks should realize that Bruce was responsible. Bruce developed the Shimano water weigh-in system. The work you did over the years, Bruce, led directly to Shimano introducing that live release water weigh-in system, and it just has proven to be so incredibly effective.
Thank you, Gord. That's nice that you remembered that.
Well, how could I? Truly, honestly, if I was in charge of Ontario's fisheries management, I would not allow a tournament in Ontario to occur unless it was water weigh-in. And you demonstrated, you showed, again, Bruce, protecting those. And I think that you're absolutely right. Anglers just don't realize in a bass tournament, we're often handling a huge percentage of the old fish, the big fish population. And they're absolutely essential to go back. And the whole point of being in a live release tournament is that they live after you let them go.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I don't want to take this into a dark area, but I guess a few years ago we became famous for cleaning up after a bass tournament that went badly down here. And I think, you know, that's not normally the case, which is a good thing for the industry. But we had to bring a number of mortality dead fish back to Queens. When we aged the fish that didn't survive at this badly run tournament, we determined that the population had lost, I think it was 1,700 years of growth.
Wow.
Yeah. So losing a bunch of fish at a badly run event was that important. So for both organizers and anglers, that's a pretty important thing to learn.
Yeah, that should be a wake up call to a lot of people, really.
I think it was for some.
Yeah. That's good.
Bruce, you also touched on something I think we should come back to, and that is when we were talking about smaller fish versus older fish and their habits. You kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, if we take 6, 8, 10, 12-inch walleyes or bass or trout or whatever, those fish are much more prone to predation, aren't they? Where they live. And it's something, again, I don't think most anglers realize is, but big fish, on the other hand, they can optimize where they live. They can optimize what they eat. And it just keeps, it's almost, again, exponentially important to the overall population for them to get bigger and bigger. But can you speak to the fact that those smaller 6, 8, 10-inch walleyes and bass and trout are much more prone to predation?
Absolutely. There are a number of examples, and actually one of the interesting examples is bluegills and sunfish. Is their smaller, less mature fish will hide in the grass and hide in the weeds for a certain portion of their life. And only when they're big enough to reduce the threat of predation will they venture out into open water. And that's one example. But because I've been interested in this kind of thing for quite a while and teach about it, I've talked with different groups and classes about the fact there are even big fish spots. And I think some anglers are aware of this, that if you go catch a big fish off a spot, if that fish gets removed, when you catch another fish off that spot, say a year or two later, it's often also a big fish. And they're just like when Mark Ridgway and I talk and he tells me that those big males are picking the best spawning areas, getting there early and picking the best spawning areas for smallmouth bass. With trout, it might be a feeding area in a stream, but researchers have shown that the biggest fish will occupy the best part of that stream to get the most food and energy reserves. And if you remove that fish, even experimentally, another big fish will take its place.
And just because it's so prime.
It's so prime. Yeah. And it's, again, something that, you know, evolution has fine-tuned over millions of years for that kind of thing to happen.
Do you think those big fish, back to the knowledge side of things, do you think they just know that that's a better spot based on previous experience?
I would say so. I think it's blown me away to read as much literature as I have in recent years about learning and fish. And I mentioned I go give talks to angling groups, often bass anglers. And to talk to them about what fish can learn just blows people away. It's crazy. In fact, there are scientists that are medical researchers, and they spend a lot of their entire career working on a small little fish called a zebrafish, because it's easy to grow in the lab, and because a lot of the learning in zebrafish and how brains work is actually similar to what happens in the human brain. There's a whole body of literature, and I talk to people about why sometimes I have insights that some other people don't have. I get to look at this literature all the time as part of my teaching. And sure enough, there are medical researchers that have shown how many different things that zebrafish can learn and how just what we're talking about. They learn the prime area in the tank. Fish can learn how to push a lever and get food over time.
Wow.
And so that if you want to grow fish the most efficiently in aquaculture or hatchery system, you can actually get, if you wanted to do it, you can get fish that are probably older fish in this case to learn how to push the lever and get the food to drop into the tank. And over time, the other fish will learn how to do that from those bigger, older fish.
It's like a
now,
dog.
Now, the interesting thing, Bruce, is our last podcast guest was Rob Swainson. And Rob was responsible, just the most incredible story. That podcast actually came out today. But Rob was responsible for saving the brook trout in the Nipigon River and Lake Nipigon. So when you get to the hatchery perspective, what Rob was saying is the worst fish to put in a hatchery were actually Nipigon strain because they're so wild. And so what do most people do? And it's coming back, I guess, a little bit to what we talked about earlier. What fish do we usually put in hatcheries? They are the ones that are docile, the ones that you can walk up to, the ones that you can feed by hand, and now you put them out into the river. And I'll always remember, I was with M&R in Thunder Bay. I was working in the ADM's office when we were trying to rehabilitate lake trout after lamprey eels. And our biggest problem stocking during the daytime was the lake trout would come up when a seagull flew over and they'd see a shadow and they were getting picked off and eaten. And it's the sorts of things we don't think about. And Rob was saying a Nipigon strain, wild Nipigon strain brookies are so wild that they don't function well in hatcheries.
That totally makes sense to me. We have the same challenges sometimes when we try to bring different wild stocks into the lab to do experiments. And I've had a lot of other experiences that have taught me the same thing. I used to work with people that were part of the Fisheries and Oceans Atlantic Salmon program on the east coast of Canada, and there was a group of hatcheries that produced Atlantic salmon. And they were very forward-thinking biologists. And one of the things that they were playing with around the time that, we were working together was creating natural rearing ponds that were part of the stream that those fish would eventually be released into. And they would allow them to get exposed to predators and eat insects and other forage before they released them into the wild. And that this was, I think, an incredibly forward-thinking way of doing it, because it would precondition those fish to, instead of moving toward big objects and get picked off by a heron or another predator, they would learn to flee from those objects. Mm-hmm. And all those behaviors that tend to be opposite of what we would like to see once we release hatchery fish, could be, some of those could be avoided. But unfortunately, hatchery fish are trained in almost you know, a whole suite of wrong behaviors for survival in the wild. I'll say that.
Yeah, you have to be extra.
Yeah, Rob said the same thing. He said, you know, actually, they're good in some respect because when you plant them, they all get caught.
Good point.
Sorry, Liam, you wanted to say something.
I was just saying something dumb. I was going to say you have to be really, really mean to them while they're in the hatchery so that they're scared of large objects.
In a way, you do. But it, you know, it speaks to some real serious issues that we're trying to grapple with these days, because you know, we're talking a lot about game fish and species that are important to anglers, but in terms of species at risk or species like we've got a program in Lake Ontario where they're trying to restore an Atlantic salmon population that was extirpated. It went extinct in Lake Ontario. And the challenges with that are incredible. And part of it is even just what we're talking about, producing fish artificially in a hatchery to a certain stage and then trying to release them and expect them to know how to survive, what to eat, you know, how to flee predators. All those things are things that now we're talking about as learned behaviors.
So it's hard to just introduce something, especially where there's a lot of predators up in like some of the stock lakes up in Northern Ontario. They get rid of, like, they're usually just little lakes with not much in them, but they'll get rid of everything else in them so that when you put in those stocked fish, it's just those fish. So realistically, all they have to do is figure out how to eat. Their only real predator is, I mean, cannibalism and, like, birds and stuff or other animals. Right. But what I don't think a lot of people understand in large lakes is that they're extremely complex ecosystems, and every species plays its own role. And then, so that just goes to the point where big fish matter even that much more, because big fish matter in the sense of their own population, but it's also a complicated ecosystem down there. So their population is playing a role to the overall lake. So big fish are supporting the population, which is supporting the lake. So it's just...
Absolutely. And you know, the further down you dig into these things, the more we learn. And I think, you know, the details kind of go on endlessly, but there are some major lessons. And sometimes I teach those. I just gave a review the other day because it's the end of term, and I teach those as important course themes. You know, in our review sessions, we talk about some of those. And, you know, some of these, as we're talking now, are that we can't easily fix the problems, as Gord mentioned, once we cause them with some of these fisheries. So removing those big fish and, as you're talking about, Liam, changing the ecosystem and the food web and how it works, and then trying to go back and fix that, it's like, you know, it's like somebody unfamiliar with mechanics trying to repair a Mercedes-Benz, you know? You know, we're just learning the simplest things. And in fact, there are so many relationships in these systems that we are just learning about now, or probably, I'm going to say, have yet to understand.
Yes.
Right.
Bruce, what it has led to, both the big fish matter theme and BOFs, and we kind of touched on this earlier. What it has led, I think, to is a resounding endorsement of maximum size limits or minimum size limits in the case of muskies, always remember here on Lake of the Woods. When I came to Lake of the Woods here in 76, believe it or not, 40 inches, that's what much, and we moved to 48. And I always remember Tom Mazendie, who was in charge of our fisheries assessment unit. Tom said it was amazing how fast the minimum size, that's what the fish became. And then we moved to 52, 54, and lo and behold, amazing, we're seeing 52 and much, much faster than we ever saw before. And anyway, we now have slot limits, minimum size limits. I'm assuming you endorse those sorts of things?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. And I think on top of that, if there's anything I could say, and I was thinking of this as we're chatting, because one of the funny things humans do is we're always challenging to say, okay, and in a good way in some ways, but to say, okay, well, show me the evidence for that. And what you're talking about is first of all, right here, is that, yes, if you raise that size limit, then those fish appear really fast, and you'll have those fish in the population.
Yeah.
And I think the message I'd like to add into this discussion is that sometimes we may not have the exact evidence for an exact species or situation, or sometimes in these angling committees you're talking about, someone says something like, well, we don't know that that occurs for the walleye in our lake. And what fishery science has really taught us, and this gets back to the common themes I teach in class, is that while we might sometimes not have the exact evidence, we need to be more precautionary and use the evidence that we have in a different way. So if we're seeing that big fish matter in a multiple number of lakes, in a multiple number of species, and in a multiple number of situations, then I think it's fair to say that we need to think about protecting those big fish in all these populations.
Yeah.
Because sooner or later, people are going to produce the evidence that will show that that's the case, and in a multitude of different ways. So being more precautionary is a huge thing that managers and now that we have people, you know, we're all participating in selective harvest. We're choosing which fish to release, which fish not. I would say to everybody, be more precautionary and release those big fish, whether there's a slot limit that tells you so or not.
Right. No, I 100% agree. I mean, obviously, there's going to be some differences from population to population, and maybe size based on forage or feeding habits or a bunch of different things. But those are minor compared to the statement that big fish matter. And I think it'd be naive to ever think that big fish don't matter in any body of water.
Exactly. Because I think what we're seeing in general, and I talked about this earlier when I said, you know, as a scientist, it's fun to see the picture come into focus on these issues, is what we're learning is that there are so many ways that big fish matter, and that the list just keeps getting longer. And it's not going in the other direction. That we're just getting more and more and more evidence, whether it's from commercial fisheries, recreational fisheries, how valuable those big fish are.
Yeah.
And how hard it's going to be to fix that population if we remove them.
Yeah, the damage is just kind of done at that point. I mean, yeah, the whole food web, the entire ecosystem is just, it's tainted.
Well, and I have to give a shout out to, you know, the late Jeffrey Hutchings, that was a Dalhousie professor that spent a lot of the last half of his career working on the cod fishery and trying to understand why the cod populations are not coming back in the North Atlantic. And it has to do, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we removed that old age structure from the population.
Yeah. Huh.
You know, Bruce, Liam and I and the folks listening, we can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast today. If we had to put a bottom line on it, I think we could say that big fish are the rock stars of the fishery world. Do you have any last thoughts to leave us with, to keep us thinking in the days ahead?
Yeah, no, I love that statement, and I think it's, you know, as scientists, we tend to talk in scientific terms, and sometimes I'll say things in class, and people will look at me with a quizzical look, and so I think that in getting the message out, I think that that's a fabulous way to do it, because I think so many people can relate to that, that they are the rock stars of these fish communities, and we should respect them that way.
Yeah.
And every time we catch one, we are holding the future of fishing in our hands.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's another thing that goes along with this.
Bruce, I totally agree. Thank you ever so much for doing this with us. Maybe we'll come back, 6 months or a year from now, and we'll talk about some of the other phenomenal work you're doing, whether it's water weigh-in systems. I know you were involved in the new management for bass in Lake Ontario, but hopefully we'll come back and do another show with your approval.
I would love to do that, Gord. This is always fun.